had two major stories break this week that were widely covered. And, you know, we had Heather Rae Bybee revealed as a fake Cherokee. The other story would be, you know, I really cover a lot of issues on corruption, even in Indian country, and the Honor the Earth and Winona LaDuke's lawsuit, which they lost. I would definitely recommend people to look into that because it's important that we have good people representing us.
We got to go. Thank you so much, Jacqueline Keeler. Sure. Appreciate it. Okay. Bye-bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
Getting so near, rocking our hearts, rocking the reds. Carrying on like he ain't been gone. Warmaker's back.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. Masks and proof of vaccination are required at this time. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
If capitalism has proven to be so hostile to life on Earth, how does it endure for so long? I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
There's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. People don't feel that they can do very much.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Virtually everybody in the 21st century, it seems, has come to an understanding that capitalism is not so much an invented, controlled, and manipulated construct as it is nearly universally accepted as simply a law of nature, like supply and demand. The damage that capitalism has done is remarkable. What explains its tremendous tenacity then? Economic, social, and governmental systems which have tried transcending and replacing capitalism by implementing the anti-capitalist ideas of Marx and Engels have largely proved insufficient. Even in the massive powerhouse countries of Russia and China, capitalism, it seems, now rules. Hardly a worker paradise with equality for all, there are now actual billionaires in those allegedly communist countries. Even in Marxist places like Cuba, Laos, and Vietnam, free market capitalism has shoehorned itself in. So is that it? Has unfettered free market capitalism simply proven itself superior and that's why it lasts? Is it just the way it is? As the profits to the very few continue to leap into the stratosphere, it's ironic and frankly terrifying that the results of the continued operation of the system has become an actual existential threat to the Earth, to all life itself. Our guest today, Peter Dolak, penned an article on Counterpunch asking the difficult but truly necessary question, how does an economic system so hostile to life endure for centuries? He notes capitalism seems firmer in the saddle than ever, spreading its suffocating tentacles to virtually every place on Earth. End of quote. As the kids today might ask, WTF? I can't say the rest of it on the air. Peter Dolak is a longtime activist and writer whose writings can be found on Counterpunch and on his blog, Systemic Disorder. He's the author of the book, It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment, and his newest book, What Do We Need Bosses For? That'll be published later this spring by Autumn Autonomedia, I have to say that right, his counterpart's article uses as a base for his multi-pronged query insights and observations in a new book by Soren Mao called Mute Compulsion, A Marxist Theory of the Economic Power of Capital. Mao is a professor and postdoctoral researcher based in Copenhagen, Denmark, and he's an editor of the journal Historic Materialism. Well, Pete, thanks so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive. It's a heck of a struggle to keep democracy alive these days.
It seems like it's a greater struggle than ever these days, certainly. Now we're it's almost like being back in the 1930s, you know, with the Trump forces. You have certain parallels to fascism.
Indeed.
It's not there yet, although Trump personally seems to have aspirations to being a fascist dictator. Fortunately, he does not have anywhere near sufficient support to achieve his goals, thankfully, but then we have other people like Ron DeSantis in the wings. So the danger, we're very much in a danger position these days. I think there's no question about it to anyone who's paying attention.
Yes, no question about it. And banning books is like, that's the first step. Well, today's enthusiastically ignorant political right denies historical reality. Of course, they have to deny it. They erase history. The demonstrable fact is that capitalism is based on the exercise of what you recognize as violence. It's based on violence, draconian laws, slavery, and colonialism. It did not just spring up naturally. Slavery, as much as others might deny it, it was not some errant, rare deviance from the creation of what is now America. Violent racism is at our core. The settling of the West, the so-called settling of the West. That was then. We don't rely on that anymore. Or do we? Only more subtly. And as you note, Pete, violence is not necessarily ever faced by a typical working person in the advanced capitalist countries. End of quote. I'm reminded of my inspiring former political science professor so many decades ago who defined politics as the economy of violence. Please, Pete, give some examples of the violence that was applied so copiously in capitalism's early days and how it was not such a rarity.
Right. Well, no, it wasn't a rarity at all. Of course, capitalism evolved very slowly, literally over a period of centuries, and of course, unevenly, more quickly, sooner in Northwest Europe, in particular England, but also in what's present-day Netherlands and Belgium, known as the United Provinces back in those days, and then gradually spread around the globe to our current situation. So how did capitalism evolve out of feudalism? And, a lot of the contradictions and blockages within feudalism were slowly eroded as trading slowly became a bigger and bigger part. And lords wanted luxury consumption. And as trade expanded with East Asia, and then eventually had colonialism in the Americas with first silver mining and gold mining, and then that quickly morphed into all kinds of production all sorts of crops that you can't grow in Europe, or for that matter in North America, you could grow in the Caribbean. So crops like sugar, rum, things like that became very valuable. These were rare luxury items in those early days. Now, how do you mass produce that? You've already decimated the native people of the Caribbean and the North American and South American mainlands. There's not enough Europeans there to do this. So what do? You tap into what were pre-existing slavery networks, but you morph it way beyond where it used to be. Now in country, like places like the Ottoman Empire, slavery was not unknown before the era of European imperialism. But in a place like the Ottoman Empire, slavery was at a drastically smaller scale, not that it's acceptable in any scale, of course, but the slaves were used for, household servants, as soldiers, even as administrators. So they weren't used to accumulate or produce profits, whereas they were taken from Africa and used to as slaves to produce the sugar and the rum and all these various products there, and these were enormously profitable. Yes. And those profits go back to England or France or where have you, or to Spain, along with all the silver that was being pumped on, particularly out of the South American Andes. And this is where the capital came for those places in Europe to build their infrastructure, to create the investment capital to invest, and now they could go on to other places and had the money to invest and take over and establish other things. And at the same time, as they gradually learned how to sail around Africa and off into the rest of Asia, gunboat diplomacy. Distress on the gunboat, of course, where they went in there and literally at gunpoint, like, okay, you know, we're taking over your trading networks. You're going to start trading with us, whether you like it or not. I mean, it got so extreme in the second half of the 19th century in China, where Britain was trying to pump opium into China. And needless to say, the Chinese government, tottering as it was, didn't want any point of this. And at some point, they finally said, "Okay, that's it. No more opium." And we're going to burn everything and destroy all the opium we can get. And Britain's response to that was to send in the Navy and invade China at several points and force a very uneven treaty whereby China was now required to take mass quantities of opium, which were incidentally grown in India. So now in India, they're not growing subsistence crops for themselves, but they're growing opium for export into China. And of course, the Indians are not getting any of the profits of that, needless to say. And what was the basis for Britain doing such an incredible thing? Well, Britain said, well, it's our right to trade. Now, just think about this crazy concept here. It's our right to trade, i.e., it's our right to force this terrible product, opium, which we don't allow at home and we don't use ourselves, and we hang any of our own people who use the stuff, but we're going to force it on other people because it's highly profitable for us. And at this point, also, you had some United States interests who were also cutting in on the action then. Yep. Of course, Britain was still the leading imperial power at those days. Yes. Until the U.S. edged out the Brits and kind of took over that role during the interwar period, and then completely at the end of the Second World War. So, this is a process that unfolded over decades. And we haven't even gotten into the internal struggles that went on in places like Britain, which, of course, feudalism was a very rural, agricultural based kind of economy. Most of your production was for your own use, or maybe to go to the market once a week for your neighbors and exchange whatever needed to be exchanged. Nobody can be completely self-sufficient, of course. And so how do you create the workforce to go into the factories when the peasants, not living high on the hog, but, serfdom is well in the past, and, they don't have the best deal, but they're basically self-proficient and they're okay on their things. So at the same time, wool production becomes a big luxury item and other things. So some of the lords decided, going to be more profitable to get into the wool industry. So they start kicking the peasants off and converting their farmlands into sheep grazing areas there. Now, where are the peasants are going to go? They've got to go somewhere. So Britain now passes, and it was far only from Britain and the continent, you had a lot of equally draconian laws, where they press all kinds of laws where if you were caught begging at your first time, they would literally brand you and warn you, and your second time begging, they would execute you. I mean, this is how draconian it was, and all kinds of other rules. So basically, like, you got kicked off the land, you've got nowhere to go, you can't survive, you can't beg, you can't ask for alms, so your only choice is to go into the factory. And why else would somebody go from being a semi-self-sufficient a farmer, even on a small basis, to working 14 or 15 hour days, 6 days a week, under sweatshop conditions? Nobody who would do such a thing. Nobody would. So people had to be forced into doing this, and from thus you created the first working class in England. Now, of course, you had bits of wage labor in England, on the continent, and other places, but it was a very small part of the economy. The economy was basically on feudal lines. Now, as all these processes continued to get bigger and bigger and develop further and further, and as the reach of the capitalists went further and further around the world, eventually the capitalist system developed out of feudalism, and once the Industrial Revolution came along, that pretty much so greatly increased the power of the early countries that they became able to use more force to continue this process, further develop it, and over time, now we get to today's world where, you know, capitalism is in, you know, every nook and cranny of the world. There's almost no place where those tentacles don't extend to.
And the so much of what you said, you know, the force is necessary, and the to defend it and to try to justify it by saying, well, it's just our right to trade. Boy, does that ever cover up a whole bunch of stuff. The book that you discussed in your Counterpunch piece is titled Mute Compulsion. Interesting title. What, tell us, please, about what its author means and in what ways violence no longer needs to be demonstrated directly to produce the same desired effects, keeping working people in their deeply, deeply subordinate place and accepting it quietly. How is politics still the economy of violence?
That gets us to the heart of the matter, of course. That phrase, mute compulsion, that's actually the author's, Soren Mao's translation from the original German. Marx wrote most of his big works, including the three volumes of Capital, in German. Mm. Now, the common, and I have no ability to speak or write German, so I can only tell this secondhand, but the standard translation of that is usually dull compulsion, and Soren Mao's contention, and he does discuss this in his book, that actually mute compulsion would be the better translation in his view, and you know, it is a little bit more poetic than dull compulsion, as my partner said to me, and I think she's right about that. So what does that actually mean? And what that means is people there's a hidden compulsion to force people to, you know, stay with the program, as it were, i.e., you know, you get up, go to work, you work for capitalists, and you hand over your surplus labor, or your surplus value, I should say, to your employer, the capitalist. So I guess I should explain that term, because, you know, we in the capitalist world are not generally familiar with those terms. Now, this all comes down to, where does profit come from? Now, what the standard would be, well, you buy low and you sell high. Mm-hmm. Well, if the entire economy was a flea market, yeah, that would be the source of profit. And obviously, for one individual, that can be a sort, you know, you've got something around your house, you catch that you don't want anymore, and you sell it, well, you might make a profit on that. Although, I guess if it's an old couch, you likely wouldn't. But anyway, that's not how a whole modern capitalist economy works, obviously. So now we get down to the question of use value versus exchange value. And this is another difference between feudalism and capitalism, whereas in feudalism, production was for use value, i.e., you made it for yourself, or maybe you might have traded it with your neighbor for something that they made that you need, or something like that. But basically, you weren't producing for a market. You weren't producing it to sell it. Producing it because, you know, it's a necessary thing. Now, in capitalism, production is for what we call exchange value, i.e., you make it so you can sell it to somebody. You can sell it in an open market. So maybe that stuff is needed. Maybe it isn't. Mm-hmm. Now, if it were, everything were needed, you wouldn't have such a vast advertising industry. So there has to be a big advertising industry to convince us to buy all the stuff we don't necessarily need and didn't even know we wanted until, you know, was bombarded 40 times on the television. Right. I was reading through an internet article and you see the same advertisement like six times every three paragraphs, which gets rather annoying. Mm-hmm. Anyway, why did they do this? They've got to convince us to buy, because a modern capitalist society is based on consumer consumption. you know, in the United States, something like 70% of the economy is literally based on consumer consumption, i.e. all the household stuff and everyday stuff we buy, from our toothbrush up to our automobile. And in any advanced capitalist country, that's usually somewhere between 60 and 70%. So production, therefore, is for exchange. So how does the capitalist get the profit? Well, again, standard economics, which is standard ideology, would say, well, he sells it in the marketplace and gets the buying price and makes the profit. Hurrah! Oh, the capitalist, he's a genius. Look what he's done. He made his profit. Well, what actually happens is when the capitalist sells the product, he or she, that's the realization of profit. So where does it actually come from? It's because the capitalist paid the worker a lot less than what the product was valued for and sold for to make the product. Mm-hmm. So that's where the concept of surplus value comes from, i.e. you get paid a certain amount and the product or service, and this is not just for, you know, people working on an assembly line, people who or behind a computer and provide a service, and it works exactly the same way. Even if you're an accountant, say you're a good accountant, you went to a good school, you got a bachelor's, you're getting a really nice salary, so you're getting $50 an hour. Right? A good accountant is going to get paid a lot of money. That's a lot of money, okay? But probably the big accounting firm is probably billing the client at, you know, $100 an hour, $150 an hour, because, you know, the client's a big corporation. They can afford to pay that kind of thing there. So that's a big gap. So that gap between the $50 an hour that the accountant gets and the $150 that the accounting firm is billing the client, that's surplus value. Now, of course, the capitalist, you know, obviously has to pay rent or mortgage on their facility. Obviously you've got to pay for the benefits like health care. Maybe they had to take out a loan. So you've got to pay interest, all these things. You know, obviously they don't keep all of the surplus value. They have to share it out. Maybe they make a product, but they're not comfortable doing that, and they hire a distributor to distribute the product. And obviously, so all of that is sharing out of some of the surplus value. So what the capitalist ultimately keeps after sharing all that out, that's where the profit comes from, and that's how the capitalist makes the profit. So, obviously, you need workers to do this. You need people to be forced to work to do this. Now, in a capitalist system, we have a choice. We could go to work and earn a paycheck, or we could starve and become homeless. So it's not really a difficult choice to make, whether we have a regular employment or, say, we freelancers. You know, I currently am regularly employed these days. Fortunately, I work for a good company, so I'm good luck there. But in my past, I had a three-year stretch where I freelanced, and, you know, you're always out on the lookout for work, and, you know, so it was very easy to be disciplined about it, even when you didn't have a regular job. Well, I'd like to pay my rent, and I would like to eat, so therefore I'm going to get this job done. It was not a hard decision. It's not a hard decision for any of us. So it's this whole system that's in place that compels you, the compulsion.
Yes.
To go to work. And if you're lucky, maybe you have a good job and you actually get a good wage, and, you know, you could put something away for your retirement and your vacation, what have you. For a lot of people, you don't have good luck, and you've got to take whatever bad job, whatever low paying job is out there, with miserable conditions and a miserable boss and maybe a really long commute, especially if you live in place like New York area, like I do, but you don't have a choice, because, you know, how else are you going to eat? How else are you going to keep a roof off your help? So that's what compels people to take all these bad, awful jobs, to even work in sweatshop conditions. Yep. And of course, outside the core capitalist core, i.e. the advanced capitalist countries of North America, Europe, Japan, where the repression of workers is much worse than it is here, and they're forced to migrate. And of course, this also explains why people migrate. I mean, the right wing has crazy ideas, like people just wake up one morning and slap their head on their forehead, slap themselves and say, hey, I know, let's leave everything behind and migrate thousands of hundreds and even thousands of miles on a dangerous journey where we might get killed to go to a place where we're not welcome and don't speak the language just for the hell of it. I mean, this is what the right wing would have us think. It's ridiculous. Only people who are in really desperate situations would do such a thing. And the fact that millions of people, tens of millions of people, are in such desperate shape that they would do such things tells us how well this whole system is working.
So a wall ain't going to work, let's face it. People, they're compelled. It's compulsion. For those who may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here, the show is Keeping Democracy Alive, and we're kind of really getting a lesson in what capitalism really is about. And it's something that we don't think about every day. Our guest is Pete Dolek, who's got an article in Counterpunch asking the question, how does an economic system so hostile to life endure for centuries? And we are learning how it does. And I was taught back in high school that what separates man from other mammals is that we are the tool makers, the others are not. Well, actually, that's debatable. It seems like some other mammals do make tools and use them. You observe that humans use tools not for convenience, but because of necessity, and that human tools are absolutely crucial for understanding how such a thing as economic power is possible. Please explain how the use and access of tools builds the case that your author Mao means by mute compulsion. It's about ownership and control of the means of production, correct? Bringing us back to
that's absolutely correct, Bert. Indeed so. Now, modern production, you've got, you know, first we think of a factory with a big assembly line, you know, at the automobile factory or something like that. Or maybe we're in a service industry and we have computers and we have supply chains that go around the world that we have to manage. You have all kinds of complexities to do that. Right? The individual person, we don't have the facilities. How many of us could go out and say, yeah, I'd like to start up a factory? You know, we don't have the capital. We don't have the money to do anything like that. So this is another way that we're forced to become employees, or i.e. sell our labor power, because that's what we do. We have the ability to labor, i.e. the ability to do a job, and we accept employment. So again, because the employer gets the profit by paying us much less than the value of what we produce,
of course,
the surplus value, therefore, you know, again, we're compelled to do this because only the big employer, you know, has the capital and the means to supply all these tools. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, in some industries we can work as a freelancer, you know, say we're a writer or an editor, which is how I personally earn my living, and I could do that at one time. I think it would be much more, I don't think I could do that now because conditions are just different, where, you know, I didn't really need too many means of production. I needed a computer and an internet hookup to be able to send the work out. Even this is in the 1990s when the internet was pretty new.
Yeah.
But all I was as a freelancer or an independent contractor, I guess to use a more technical term, is, you know, I was an employee without a regular job. That's really what it amounted to. So if you're a freelancer, you're still basically employee. You're just, you know, have a lot of different employers, and your periods of employment may be short unless you have a long-term deal for yourself. So again, because the capitalist has the means of production, has the tools, has, you know, the assembly line and everything that goes into it, or maybe you work in construction and the employer there has the trucks and the big earth moving equipment and all the other things that are necessary to do that. You don't have that. So for you to earn a living, this is another area of compulsion. You've got to go and hire yourself out to the employer who does have those tools, i.e. the, you know, the means of production, to use the technical term.
Mm-hmm. And you know, we were the violence, the oversight, you know, you don't have to see it all the time, but the control of the tools is still there. I interviewed an old friend about his book on Amazon. The people don't realize, you know, they think about, well, I'll just, you know, Amazon, what a cool system, it delivers it really quickly. They have you can, every inch, every millimeter, it seems, of those factories are monitored by cameras. That's, you know, really kind of adverse working conditions, that's for sure. And so it goes on and on. And, you know, it's not the overt slavery that there's been before, but it's still mute compulsion, as the title of the book is there. And go ahead.
Yes, yes. Boy, I have an enormous respect for the people in Amazon who are organizing those unions and going Amen. Through so much and facing such an all-out battle. You think about how much they're spending more money fighting the unions than it would be to just say, okay, yeah. have your union and we'll pay you a fair wage. But of course, the power conception comes into play here. So, you know, how does technology get used in an unequal world? I'm often reminded, I like to read science fiction, and I remember Arthur C. Clarke would always write, you know, there is no evil technology, there are only evil uses of technology. And I've always been inclined to agree with that, because what could technology do? Think about, you know, if we had control of our workplaces, say we work cooperatively, where, you know, we all, you know, one person, one share, say, or whatever relationship we had, or even if a company were state-owned, but it was democratically run and open to, you know, public protests, et cetera, where we had genuine control. We weren't a cog in a machine, but, you know, we were one of the creators of the product or service that was being produced in a given country, company, excuse me, then, you know, technology would be a good thing. We could use it to save our labor, to maybe cut costs, maybe to make our distribution system better, i.e. we could use it to, you know, maintain the profitability of the company, distribute among ourselves, and maybe distribute it some to our surrounding community, since we're part of our community. And this would be technology now would be applied in a positive way to help us and to lessen and reduce the stress of our work day. Now, that would be the best way yes. of applying it. But what happens in an unequal situation, especially a drastically unequal company like Amazon, it becomes a tool of coercion, of control, and where, you know, you're reduced to literally a cog in a machine. I mean, we've all read, I certainly have, all the horror stories of what it's like to work at Amazon, where people literally have to urinate in a bottle because they can't take 5 minutes to go to the bathroom because they're off clock for too long. I mean, I can't imagine that level of inhumanity. I mean, in a humane run place, who would institute such a thing? That's insane. I mean, we're human beings, and but where you have such coercive, one-sided things, technology now becomes an evil because it's applied in an evil way. And, you know, a lot of this is going around, maybe not quite as Amazon, I guess, is the most drastic example. But, you know, I hear oftentimes people who are working at home in white collar service kind of jobs, and there's bossware installed on there. So if there's not a keystroke in a certain period of time, you know, they get rung up. It's like, why aren't you working? You know, again, this kind of surveillance stuff, it's a consequence of capitalism. It's a consequence of the drastically unequal relations between employer and employee.
Yes, there certainly is. It's certainly not equal. And economic democracy is a possibility. It can happen. It has happened, and people get frustrated. You know, there are never good results when people feel powerless over their own destiny. And so many people do these days everywhere. There's this anger at the largely amorphous but immensely powerful institutions which exercise such power over people's lives. And people feel really frustrated and angry. And we've seen all too often right-wingers claim to be populist, and I suppose maybe they are, but they take advantage of this frustration. They're able to capture it. Viktor Orban's Hungary, Bolsonaro's Brazil, and Trump's America. You know, they take the anger and, you know, use it to increase their own dictatorial power. And you write that Dr. Mao examines the definition of power. You cite his quote, this quote, "The power of capital can thus be defined as capital's capacity to impose its logic on social life." What did he mean, and how does that manifest itself in ways we've seen in the 20th and 21st century? Can you give us some examples?
Okay. Some of the examples are what we've already talked about, how people are compelled to take bad jobs to endure awful working conditions, etc. That's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it, as corporations get bigger and bigger and get their fingers in more and more things and get more and more capital and become more and more powerful, what do? They naturally want to tilt the scales even more into their favor. So now you have here in the United States, you have a system that's all based on, if you want to get office, you need big, massive amounts of donations. So who has the money to give big, massive amounts of donations? It's the corporations, and it's the top executives there who collect these enormous amounts of money. So they, hand out all this money, and, they don't really have to coerce it. I'm sure there's never a conversation where the donor says to the political candidate, "Okay, you know what's expected of me now." I doubt very much there's any arm wrestling at all, in that sense. But the recipient of it knows, where his bread is buttered, and even if they don't think about it quite that way, they know where their donations are coming from and what perspective is having the influence on them. So if all you hear is the perspective of big pharma or big corporations and this or that industry, and you don't hear the experiences of labor, of working people, of community leaders, well, how are you going to tilt? Naturally, you're going to tilt by the people who have all the influence on you, who have your ear. And if they're also the ones giving you all your money, without which you cannot get office, well, you're going to, whatever you might think, you're going to kind of over time bend that way, and it's just going to become like a natural thing there. So what do these corporations expect? This is not just simply largesse. "Hey, we think you're a really nice guy. We'd like to see you in office." It's not like that at all, of course. And so, they're expecting things. So, they come along and say, this environmental regulation, it's really kind of crimping our profits. So, here we've come up with the bill here. You can tinker and toy with it here, but we think it'd be really good. It would really help for jobs. This is why everything is always that way. We'll be able to create more jobs if our profits go up. And the political office also says, "Oh, more jobs, good, that will make me more popular." So maybe not be thinking along the lines of, yes, it's not so mechanical that, yes, my donor demanded I do this, therefore I would do that. It's very likely to not be mechanical, certainly in most cases. It's more of a matter of you're already open to the influence of the donor, and they're saying, this will create more jobs. Well, that will make me popular. I'll get reelected if people have more jobs. Okay, this sounds good to me. I think this is a good idea. So that goes in there, and other people in the party are getting the same thing, and probably people in the other party are getting much the same thing as well. So they all get together and, mark it up, make some tweaks, change a little things, maybe have to make a concession in there to get enough people to get it over the line, but it gets over the line, and sure enough, it goes in, and the profits go up, and those pesky environmental regulations are gone, and profits have gone up. Isn't everything wonderful? Except, of course, they're not hiring more people. Where is all that extra profit gone from? It's going into the shareholders' pockets and into bonuses for the executives. And you see studies on this, because periodically, at least once a year, I like to write about all these dividends and share buybacks, which is another way of juicing the stock price and therefore indirectly putting more profit into big corporate pockets. And There are years when the composite of the biggest corporations, the Fortune 500, the composite of what they pay out in dividends and spend on stock buybacks is greater than their profits. So where is that money coming from? They're probably, taking out a loan somewhere, or maybe they're even selling more shares at the same time that they're buying back other shares, to keep to keep this craziness going. So there's nothing productive about this. In fact, just the opposite is about the most unproductive thing you can do. So hooray for more profits. That means we're going to raise our dividend. We're going to buy back more shares. And then now the profits will be shared among fewer shareholders. The shareholders are going to be very happy. And Wall Street's going to bid that stock price up. And the CEO, a part of his package, is in stock options and in stocks. So he's very happy to see that. And the Wall Street, you know, Wall Street has a lingo for everything. So the lingo there is aligning, is having the executives' interests aligned with shareholder interests. And isn't this a wonderful thing? So what you get is you get you get Wall Street finance capital, you get the executives there, and they wrangle all the time who gets the bigger share of the pie. But they do agree on one thing. They get all the pie. Workers, who of course it's their work, who actually create the pie in the first place. Well, they don't do anything. They're lowly workers. We gave them a paycheck. When you know they got health insurance, what more do they want? Go away. What are you talking about? So they battle each other out, and often will sue each other in court. Now, I one time in my life, I actually spent a couple of years on the lead financial wire service of Dow Jones, the ticker. Oh, wow. So it was an education. So it was all the things I thought I knew about finance, and then I saw, it all really is true. It really does work the way I think it does. So it was the endless stream of press releases, and you know, at the end, you know, they give whatever news they give, and then, you know, a little paragraph at the end of what their business is. And always business was always, you know, so-and-so company, you know, makes widgets for the widget industry and enhances shareholder value. And time and again, you'd always see this, whatever product or service, and enhancing shareholder value. This is what their company did. Now, enhancing shareholder value, that's kind of an odd-sounding phrase. What could that mean? And that means one thing. We're going to do whatever it takes so that our stock price goes up. If we've got to lay off a bunch of workers, because that's the sort of thing that makes Wall Street very happy, that's what we'll do. If we have to take our profits and not, you know, say, let's give bonuses to our workers who created that. Instead, we'll take all that money and we'll buy back the shares. And now the share price will go up because less shareholders will be sharing the profits. That makes Wall Street really happy. So these are the sorts of things that enhance shareholder value. And you see this all the time. I mean, time after time after time on all the press releases. So it tells you who calls the tune.
And who controls the language has the power. You know, job creators. That was brilliant. I remember seeing that, you know, job creators. Boy, people actually bought into that. For those who may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking about an important aspect of our society, what capitalism really is. Our guest today is Pete Dulock, who's written a very interesting article on Counterpunch, asking the question, how does an economic system so hostile to life endure for centuries? And it's not, you know, there is violence, there is compulsion, but the politicians, virtually all of them, rely on big money from big corporations and ultra wealthy people. However, there was Bernie Sanders. He was able to raise a whole, but he shocked the heck out of them by raising an average of $27 per contributor. A whole bunch of people, you know, like that picture of a whole bunch of little fish eating one big fish. And we also briefly mentioned economic democracy and national health insurance. You know, that other places around the world have it. It would be cheaper. It would save money to provide national health insurance. But the system is, how is it working to keep workers subservient? How is that system served by continuing to link health insurance to employment? It's frustrating to me that, you know, if you don't have a job, if you know, linking health insurance to employment, what is the aspect of that keeps people subservient?
Well, there's another thing. We all need health insurance. Maybe when we're young, we can get away with not having it. It's my case. I was much younger when I freelanced for 3 years, and I didn't have any health insurance for those 3 years. Yeah. Fortunately, I had no significant medical or dental issues, so I got away with it. But one of the reasons for eventually accepting a regular job, as at that point I was closing in on 40, and I thought, well, having health insurance, I think that would be a really good idea. So, you know, if you're a person who has some health issues, well, you really need that health insurance.
Yes.
You know, or maybe your health might be good, but maybe you have a condition and you have to take a medication that's expensive to keep yourself healthy, and maybe you couldn't afford that medication unless you had the insurance, and that insurance is attached to a job. This is the only advanced capitalist country. It's just about the only country. Most other countries also have universal health systems. So I've done a couple of articles on this, and the last time I did this, this is how I tried to calculate it. I took the composite health costs for Canada, because it's our nearest neighbor, mm-hmm. and the three biggest countries in Europe, Britain, France, Germany. And I took the composite average of those four countries and compared it to what the average health costs in the United States on a per person, and then, you know, multiplied by 300 million, our population, very roughly. I guess it's a little more than that now. And the figure I came out with, that on a yearly basis, and by now the figure would only have gone up, I did this a few years ago, the United States, we spend $1.4 trillion per year extra than the composite average of Canada, Britain, Germany, and France, you know, our nearest peer countries. There, $1.4 trillion. So that's an enormous amount of money going into big pharma, into medical establishment, all kinds of other places. And, you know, in this country, doctors are often reduced their employees of hospitals. So even we're getting to the point where even doctors technically are, you know, proletarians, to use the fancy term for a working person. You know, they're not, you know, independent business people as they used to be. Some, of course, many still are, but a lot of them are also becoming an employees.
Right.
So think about that enormous waste of money. And if we just had a universal health system, that we would have so much cheaper health care. And I think about all that money that gets drained off of that. And of course, that in a way holds down wages, because, you know, for the employer, it's very expensive for them to pay out for that. So, you know, they need to cut costs there. So, you know, shaving something off the wages that they might otherwise pay is one way of doing that. Now you look at a system like they have in France, where I believe the figure, if I'm not mistaken, is 19% is taken out of your paycheck, and that 19% goes to the French Social Security system and the French unemployment system. So, you know, and of course we've been seeing all the mass uprisings in Paris and elsewhere in there as they're trying to raise the retirement age there. You know, 62, it sounds like a pretty fair time. And of course, you know, naturally the corporate media is saying, well, everyone else in other countries, they have to wait till they're 65 or 67 to retire. You know, why should they get such a better deal? And that's part of the right-wing ideology. It's never like, hey, those people have something better, why don't we have that too? It's always, hey, they have something that you don't have, let's take it away from them. That's unfair, right? That's this mentality that they have. Because I know many conservatives in my life, and I'm always struck time and again how often their attitude is, and sometimes this is expressed not even indirectly but quite directly, but, you know, I suffered, so everyone else should suffer too. Instead of saying, well, instead of suffering, why don't we change it so maybe we could at least suffer a little bit less? So instead of saying, like, yeah, why do we have to work till we drop? Why don't we all retire at 62? Instead of saying, like, hey, look what France is able to do. They have probably about the world's best health system. They have really good guaranteed retirement. Well, we should all be able to retire at 62. But instead, it's like, hey, they've got it better than we do. Let's take that away. Right now, the current retirement age for full Social Security, you know, if you're lucky enough to get it, is 67, and of course that's going to inch up. So probably for young people in their 20s or entering the workforce, they're probably, I wouldn't be surprised if it all, I won't be long enough for them to be around long enough for them to retire, but you know, they'll probably have to be a good 70 years old to retire. You know, I can easily foresee them raising the retirement rate at that. You know, and of course we can't live on full Social Security. It's a supplement, and actually was intended to be that, you know, a supplement to whatever you get from retirement. But of course, you know, our father's generation and their fathers, you know, they had a pension, you know, that they got when they retired. You know, none of us in our generation, and certainly not the people in the generation behind me, we don't have anything like right. that. So it's, you know, whatever we can save, whatever we can manage to put into our 401k, if we're really lucky, we've got an employer who at least match part of what we put in there, and you really got to scrape together.
It's an interesting way to define freedom. You know, I mean, in a way, it's free, but boy, people are really chained. I mean, it's much more subtle chains, but it's chained. And one of the things that, you know, we've seen in the earlier part of the 20th century is that free time was something that the factory owners hated. You could not have free time. Owners of factories used to be able to restrict workers' free time to practically zero. It was never valued, never seen as useful. But in other countries, they recognized that free time, leisure time, can actually be a good thing, can help people become more productive and more, dare I say, happy. So the concept of leisure time available to all seems to be a threat to the class structure. They're realizing that other countries that more free time can be a benefit to a still capitalist economy. What are some, and you know, the lack of free time, it brings up what producing all this stuff is doing to us, you know, and there are health effects. One of the adverse effects of unrestrained capitalism, of course, is massive overproduction. They flood the market and no guardrails, just more stuff, a lot of trash. Also, climate change, which, as we said in the very beginning, may actually doom us all. It's real. Climate change is becoming more and more obvious. We can't afford to just ignore it and look away. So beneath this 21st century aspect, on a more traditional Marxian point of view, you say without the capacity of humans to produce more than what's necessary for their own survival, class society would be impossible. So my question is, where does class society and environmental degradation intersect so harmfully?
Okay, so again, as we discussed earlier, the capitalist makes the profit by paying right. the worker, the employee, much less than they produce. That's the surplus value, and that's where the profits and the accumulation of capital comes from. Now, and of course, the people at the top of the pyramid, you know, become more and more powerful and richer and able to bend more and more things their way to the point where, you know, they have decisive influence over the government, and then that all can get rules and everything changed to get everything more and more in their favor. So there has to be a surplus produced by somebody, of course, by the overwhelming majority of people, since the huge majority of people, of course, get up and go to work and work right. for somebody every day. They can only have so many capitalists out there. We mm-hmm. can't afford too many wealthy people. So think about back to the, by far and away, the longest period of human history, when our deep ancestors of the past were in the hunter-gatherer stage, right? You couldn't really have a surplus. You couldn't really have accumulation if you're a hunter-gatherer. You know, you pretty much had to work together, you know, to gather mm-hmm. the plants, and you know, maybe you went out and hunted something and had some meat once in a while. Everybody had to work together. Everybody was on the move, so you had to, you know, whatever you could carry, that was pretty much it. Now, of course, I'm not in any way suggesting we go back to the hunter-gatherer stage, of course. But the point is that until humanity began to settle in towns and began to produce agriculture and began to produce a surplus that somebody could take, only then could society start breaking down into classes where you could start having inequality and eventually get to the point where, you know, you have untouchable monarchs and slaves mm-hmm. and, you know, maybe some people in between. And of course, as we've gone through the stages of economic development over the years, from slavery to serfdom to capitalism, or I guess feudalism, serfdom was mm-hmm. being only one variation of feudalism, actually had a number of variations, but anyway, and on to capitalism, you know, these kind of inequalities persist. The class basis changes. You know, it used to be lord and peasant, now it's capitalist and worker, and of course the whole concept of socialism or economic democracy. In my case, I use those two terms interchangeably, as I do in my forthcoming book, What Do We Need Bosses For?, that's coming out this spring from Otana Media. Why can't we have everybody have a say? Why can't we run things as cooperatives where everybody has a say, or maybe some big industries? I from my own personal point of view, I think energy and banking ought to be in public hands. Yes. That shouldn't be in private hands, even as cooperatives. And I imagine different societies would want different industries perhaps to also be in that. But you know, if we have a state company that runs the water system or supplies the electricity, say, well, why can't that be under public democratic control? It should be. Yes. Why can't we have public banking, as people like Ellen Brown from the Green Party have advocated for many years? It's somebody I would definitely recommend reading. She has a good blog herself. And why not? We're all educated. You know, we're all capable of thinking as well as doing. You know, we're not brutes. And when we're in the workplace, why wouldn't we want a say in how things are run? Right. Why wouldn't we want to do it? That doesn't mean we always win. So, you know, whatever form this may be, whether there's a workers' council and everybody elects people, or you make a whole decisions by a vote of the whole thing. So, you know, a couple of days a month, you know, you don't throw the on switch on the assembly line, or you don't turn on the computer and say, you all get together and say, okay, these are the decisions that we have to make. That doesn't mean we sit there and we spend all day, how many bolts do we have to buy, or you know, should we invest in a new computer? Not these little tiny nitty-gritty things, but you know, right. The big decisions. What are we going to pay ourselves? How are we going to distribute this? You know, how much of our profit do we want to give to the community? How much do we want to give back? And what community institutions do we want to give to show our appreciation, because we're part of the community. We wouldn't be here without their support. It's a mutual thing. You know, it's kind of like in Argentina 20 years ago when everything broke down and people just took over their factories and says, okay, that's it. We're going to do it ourselves. Yeah. So they would do things like they would send somebody over to the local hospital and say, you know, we really could use some a nurse on duty. So the hospital would send a nurse, and there would be a nurse on duty in the factory, and the factory in turn would give some free products to the hospital that they needed there, and this was a reciprocal thing. So it wasn't all for money exchange. Sometimes you're doing these kinds of barter things. At the same time, of course, that the now worker-run factory obviously can't be an island unto itself. It is an island of economic democracy, but still has to be surrounded by a sea of capitalism, so they still have to produce a product that people want to buy, or somebody out there wants to buy, that's useful and of high enough quality so that it's going to get bought. So you're still subject to competitive pressures to some degree, but right. You know, it's obviously a much better deal for the people who are working there. No more, you know, and some of these cases the factory boss was really, really oppressive. Certainly not an unknown thing in factories and businesses anywhere in the world. Yeah. And now you can work at a human scale and work at a human pace, and you know, you can help make the decisions on what gets produced and why and where, et cetera. Well, why don't we all have that? Why shouldn't we all have that?
And the thing is, we can, and it does seem like the powers that be, they want us to believe that this is the only system that there can be, that there can't be anything else. And the fact is, we've bought into it, but now we're facing, you know, possibly, you know, the climate change is really serious. The UN in it, you know, says that 2035, yeah, we could be in serious, serious trouble. There are alternatives. We don't have to just sit there and buy it. There can be co-ops, as you say, shorter work weeks. Other countries do that. Worker ownership and management, especially, I agree, public utilities, water, electricity, banks. I mean, North Dakota, real conservative state, they have state-owned banks there. We shouldn't have to depend on ideas coming from the top down, but also from the bottom up. People who work it, who know the stuff, they can, and to have more free time. More free time is not such a bad thing. I mean, the old right wing, you know, is very much against free time, except for those with tremendous amounts of money. Everybody's under that compulsion, as we discussed here. But we can be more fully human. In other words, the world generally accepts how it is now, throwing up our hands, surrendering to the inevitability of global warming and actual loss of our planet's ability to sustain life, it doesn't have to be that way. There can be, as I believe it was Karl Marx who said, there can be a better world. So if people want to read more of your stuff, you have a new book coming out, Pete Dalek, and tell us about that and how they can get it.
Okay, the new book is What Do We Need Bosses For? Toward Economic Democracy. It'll be out this spring. It's imminent from Autonomy Media, a very nice left press here in Brooklyn. And I would say autonomymedia.org, if I remember correctly, is their website. Of course, it might be autonomymedia.com. Gee, I should have texted you, shouldn't I have? Anyway, to have an easily accessible website. When the book is available later this spring, it will be there. People can also check in with my blog, which is Systemic Disorder, and the address on that is systemicdisorder.wordpress.com, and if that's too much to remember, it probably would be for me, to be honest. do a text search for a Systemic Disorder blog, and it will come up. I will have, when the book is available for purchase, I will have a dedicated page for that book on that website. It'll give you all the information about that. And also you can check out my current book, which is It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment. There's also a page for that on my Systemic Disorder website as well.
Thank you so much, Professor. We've learned a lot today. I really appreciate it. Pete Dalek, thanks so much for being with us and keeping democracy alive. And maybe we can have more democracy. What a concept. Thank you.
It would be a wonderful idea. Thank you for having me.
Money. Money makes the world go around. The world go around. The world go around. Money makes the world go around. It makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. Is all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanging sound. Money, 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 money. If you happen to be rich and you feel like a knife, entertainment you can pay for the escapade. If you happen to be rich and alone and you need a companion, you can ring ting-a-ling for the mate. If you happen to be rich and you find you are left by your lover and you moan and you go and fight a lot, you can take it on the chin, call a cab and begin to recover on your 14 carat yacht. What? Money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world go round. Money makes the world go round.
If you enjoyed that discussion, don't miss a single show. Subscribe. It's all free. It's on Apple, Spotify, Progressive Radio Network, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course, the website, keepingdemocracyalive.com. Thanks very much.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
During the last 6 weeks, you heard the special programming of our winter fundraising drive.